Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we hear from two experts on ISIS in Libya. Saudi-Iran tensions bring concerns for the Syrian peace process. Our cyber guru looks at security in the web world in 2016.
We have heard consistently that IT people are constantly asking for more money, more attention, and the CEOs just haven't been paying attention. Well, they're paying attention now.
And music icon David Bowie dies after an 18-month fight with cancer. It's ahead on The Voice of America. ISIS is escalating its attacks in Libya in a campaign to create a stronghold for its fighters, taking advantage of the chaos and infighting between rival factions and militias. Experts stress the need for a united government, brokered by the UN, and a decisive international security support to prevent ISIS from having a stronghold in Libya. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with two experts on the rising threat of ISIS in Libya and how to confront it. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you, Sue.
What prompted the renewed concern about ISIS in Libya?
Well, the Islamic State group launched several attacks on Libya's major eastern oil ports, As-Sidr and Ras Lanuf, a few days ago, followed by an apparent suicide attack that targeted the police academy at Zlatan, one of the principal training centers for creating security forces loyal to the UN-brokered government of national unity, intended, in fact, to unify Libya's warring factions. The terrorist group is trying to exploit years of violence and chaos in the northern African nation to create a safe haven for its fighters. Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution stressed the fact that ISIS advances in Libya represent a multifaceted threat.
I think ISIS is a very serious threat in and from and to Libya, partly because it thrives in anarchy, partly because Libya has been a well-known source of extremists ever since the early days of the Iraq War. That pattern has continued. It's been an important source of fighters for ISIS, and because there are various ways to move about, the connectivity between Libya and the rest of the region is quite significant. And so ISIS can draw fighters from other places, but also it can take up sanctuary in Libya and then use those locations to generate people and forces for activities elsewhere.
U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby said the U.S. is committed to providing the unified government full political backing and technical, economic, security and counterterrorism assistance. But is that enough response?
According to O'Hanlon, it is a tentative move toward getting more involved, but he said the United States should lead, in fact, the charge against ISIS in Libya.
And we're going to have to respond by being ready to up our game, be more prepared, be more secure, and not be intimidated and not be talked out of this. There are various places in the broader Middle East where, after an attack in the past, we decided we just didn't need to stay engaged. And certainly Lebanon in 1983 was one example, Somalia in 1993 and 1994. And Libya has, to some extent, been that kind of a place in recent years. So the first thing we need to do is keep moving in the direction we started belatedly to move in, which is towards having a more serious plan for the training of Libyan security forces and the shoring up of a coalition government of some kind, because we just can't allow this anarchy to continue, because it presents great opportunities for ISIS and perhaps other extremists as well.
Bill Lawrence, a former director of the North Africa program at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, argues that the rising threat of ISIS in Libya is serving as a unifying factor, and he says militias from rival factions are eager to fight ISIS and fend off its expansion on the Libyan territories. However, he stressed the need for outside help. Initially, Libyans were opposing any Western security help, but with the threat of ISIS in Libya, Lawrence says there is increasing cross-sections of Libyans who would like an international force, but disagree so far on the form and the role of such help.
Right now is a key time for everyone, Libyans and internationals, to reassess how that coming Western help, which is needed, will be deployed in a way that makes things better and not worse.
Experts agree that the international community has a crucial role to play in order to prevent Libya from being a safe haven for terrorism that threatens the national security of Egypt, Tunisia, and the entire African continent.
Mohammed, thank you for bringing in different perspectives on ISIS in Libya.
Thank you, Sue, for having me.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story. And joining me with the details is social media reporter Olin Akasholu. Welcome, Olin.
Hi, Susan. Well, there's one interesting trend related to ISIS that started around this weekend. The New Yorker wrote a satirical piece saying that actor Sean Penn was planning to meet with and interview ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And a lot of people actually believed that this was a serious story, and they tweeted about the news as if it wasn't a hoax. Of course, it was believable to some people because news came out recently that Sean Penn had met with Mexican drug lord El Chapo, an interview that might have actually helped get El Chapo arrested. The story actually says that Baghdadi canceled the interview because of what happened to El Chapo. But many people recognized it was satire and had a lot of fun joking about the story. Some even suggested that Sean Penn could team up with Dennis Rodman and be a dual threat in establishing diplomatic relationships for the U.S. with North Korea and the Islamic State group.
Well, what's trending on social media right now?
So the biggest trending topic on social media continues to be David Bowie, following the news that the singer died from cancer yesterday. People are sharing tributes and some of Bowie's memorable quotes and songs from his latest album, Black Star, which was released just 2 days before his death. According to Twitter Trends, his name has already been used more than 1.5 million times in tweets in the past 24 hours. There's also social media posts made before David Bowie's death by his wife, Iman, that are being shared a lot on social media. On January 9th, 2 days ago, she posted a message that read, "Sometimes you will never know the true value of a moment until it becomes a memory." And then yesterday, before the news of her husband's death, she also tweeted, "The struggle is real, but so is God himself." If you look at her Twitter account, she regularly tweets these deep, reflective quotes, but a lot of people are saying that these are made even more powerful because of the proximity to Bowie's death yesterday.
We'll have more on that story later on our show. Thank you, Olin.
You bet, Susan.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
You may have heard that dying people have some rather amazing dreams or visions in the final weeks and days of their lives. A new study by researchers at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York, suggests that these end-of-life dreams are an important and comforting part of the dying process that improve quality of life for those about to die. While some in the medical community consider these dreams and visions to be no more than delusions or hallucinations, the researchers found that to someone dying, they're quite realistic and often very meaningful. The researchers found that the most common and most comforting theme of these visions and dreams were those of deceased family and friends. The study also showed that these dreams and visions became more frequent the closer a person came to death. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
There is concern that tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia may negatively impact the Syrian peace process, on track for another round in Geneva January 25th. Regional analyst Abdelkader Sino of Indiana University tells VOA's Victor Beatty he expects the talks to take place, but doubts there will be a breakthrough.
The talks will be on track, but they will also not have good odds to succeed, just like they did before, because the opposition is incredibly fragmented in Syria, and there are many spoilers, and the regime itself would rather gain time, because time is working in its favor right now. So they all will play along. They will all go through the movements and pretend, you know, to be part of serious negotiations, but nothing serious will probably happen.
There was a member of the opposition called the Islam Army, or Jaish al-Islam, that expressed misgivings about the talks, citing the need to see something of a goodwill measure from the government of Damascus, including a ceasefire, detainee release, and the end of blockades on besieged areas. Do you think that's possible?
It will not happen, but they are very right to request that. Listen, there are seven regions in Syria that are under blockade by the government, including Madaya, which is a city that's now heavily covered, militarized, and where you have people undergoing famine because the regime would not allow food to go in. It's brutal. You have 40,000 people in this one enclave, and you have seven of those enclaves in Syria right now. Of course, the opposition wants some relief for the population in their areas, and it's a legitimate request. But the regime, of course, will also not accept, because now it has advantage on the ground with the Russian support, the Hezbollah support, the Iranian support. And so it will be bidding for time to make more gains before it would enter serious negotiations.
Well, Damascus told Mr. de Mistura on Saturday that it was prepared to take part in the Geneva talks, but said that there's a need to see the names of the Syrian opposition figures who will take part. Will they not take part if certain names are there?
That provides them an opportunity to bow out if they need to. The thing is with that regime is that it calls most of the opposition groups terrorists. There's very few acceptable opposition groups for the regime anyway. So for them, that's a way to scuttle the talks whenever they want to and not to hold themselves responsible. It's a preemptive measure.
Abdul Qadir Sino of Indiana University. There's little doubt that 2015 will not be remembered fondly by cybersecurity professionals, with millions of successful hacking attacks and unaccounted documents breached or stolen. It seemed at times that nothing could be done to stop the assault on the globe's computer systems. So is 2016 doomed to just more of the same, or might help be on the way? Well, my buddy International Edition's Doug Bernard covers cyber for us and is joining us now here in the studio. Welcome, Doug.
Do I bring good news or bad news?
I'm hoping it's good news, because we talk so many times about unhappy things. I'm just hoping this time you were telling me there's a rainbow in the horizon.
Well, first, let's take a look back at 2015.
Okay.
It really was a wretched year in terms of cybersecurity. It was just filled with stories of massive-scale hacking attacks, data theft, all kinds of intrusions, and at times it really almost seemed like the people who are guarding our computer systems just weren't able to protect the system. So it was a discouraging year, but, you know, that was last year. We're moving on to a new year now.
Well, you've written a story, actually, saying there might be reason for optimism. Why?
I did. So there are several reasons. First, I think just the scale of last year's intrusions and data breaches has got the attention of government, leading government officials, and the people in charge at corporations. We have heard consistently that IT people are constantly asking for more money, more attention, and the CEOs just haven't been paying attention. Well, they're paying attention now, and that, I think, is bodes well for cybersecurity. But that, I think, is really just one factor of several things that are coming down the line.
For instance?
Well, for instance, I think this year we're going to see much more AI, or what they call machine learning. AI stands for artificial intelligence. Basically, the cybersecurity people are figuring out ways to design systems that aren't waiting for humans to detect an attack and then respond to it. These systems are so smart, they're actually learning from attacks and increasingly being able to predict attacks that haven't even happened yet, so they can bolster up security where they need to. So I think that's an interesting trend that we're definitely going to see more of in 2016.
This is so science fiction-like, the way these machines are taking over, you know?
Well, it does seem so, but, you know, when you think about the amount of hacking that's going on right now at this point, I would guarantee you right now somebody's trying to gain access to our website. Somebody's trying to gain access to millions and millions of websites right now as we speak. So what people have decided or realized, I think, is there just aren't enough people to defend against all these hackers. But if you let the machines do it, they never sleep, they never take a break or a weekend, you know, you're taking a step above the human hacker.
I don't know why I like you so much, Doug, because every time you come in here, you scare me every single time. And well, I hate to ask you this next question, because I know what you're going to say.
Yes.
You're going to say change your password. So I'm going to ask it anyway. What can individuals do to try to save themselves, protect themselves?
Change your password.
I knew it.
don't use the same password between various programs and systems. And I think perhaps the most important thing, actually, we've said it before, if you get an email or an attachment that you didn't ask for, Don't open it. Delete it. Don't be curious. Don't be fooled by a message that says, hey, thought you might like to see this, when you don't know really who it's from. Just be on guard. Don't be paranoid, but, you know, be watchful and aware that people are trying to get at you.
Oh, and I wanted to tell you about my mom.
Yeah.
This was a phone call, not an email, but she gets emails as well. She's very elderly. And she got this phone call, and it was on her answer machine. It said, this is the Internal Revenue Service, and you have to call us right away and give us your secret information because we're suing you. And if you don't call right away and answer our questions, you're going to be in jail. And it's scary.
Yes, it is scary. And I'll tell you something else. Another trend that I think we're going to see in 2016 very quickly is an increase in ransomware. We saw a lot of it in 2015. It's that same kind of pitch. Somebody scares you into clicking on something or doing that. And what they do is they seize control of your computer. They lock you out. And they say, we're not going to give you your computer back with all of your photos and music and everything until you pay us, I don't know, $100 or something. So again, it's really important. Don't be scared. Don't be curious. But if something seems fishy, just
don't fall for it.
Don't fall for it. Delete it.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Some sad news from the world of music. A British rock pop legend, David Bowie, has died. And joining us here from our music division is Ray McDonald. Welcome, Ray.
Hi, Susan.
Well, this is big, big news. And he's such a diverse guy. Do you take on the challenge of giving him a description?
It's really hard to do, especially in the time that we have. David Bowie was a chameleon a decade before Madonna perfected the formula for pop music. He changed personas the way other people change their outfits. He started out as Ziggy Stardust, the pop alien. From there, he went on to the Thin White Duke during his soul period. He worked with Brian Eno in Berlin in the late 70s, producing a trio of very influential albums. And later on, he would dabble in dance music for his huge hit Let's Dance with Nile Rodgers. He's done hard rock. His latest album, Black Star, which just came out last Friday on his 69th birthday, was influenced by jazz and hip-hop, according to his producer, Tony Visconti. So he had a hand in everything.
And his producer was saying that this last album that just came out, it's kind of David Bowie's gift to his fans.
That's exactly right, and I think he desperately wanted it out before he passed away. He had been struggling with cancer for the past 18 months. The news did not get out. I'm assuming that no one outside his family and closest friends knew about it. And I think that the timing of Black Star was very fortuitous. This was his parting gift.
The neat thing about him was that it covers all the ages. Young people liked him, people my age liked him. And he's got fans everywhere.
His appeal is universal. He appeals to the outsider. in all of us. Bowie said that he adopted all of these stage persona because he was so unsure of himself. He thought that he himself was a pretty boring guy, that no one would really want to see him speak or perform. So he put on all of these disguises for us.
Yes, he was kind of a fashion icon with all his different designs that he used in characters.
Yeah, his influence touched the world of fashion, the world of music, the world of literature, theater.
Yeah, he was doing a play off-Broadway.
Lazarus, yeah. He's acted in many movies. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, The Man Who Fell to Earth is an iconic movie. Pretty much everything he touched has become iconic. That's the range of his influence.
And even though he was married to a beautiful and very famous model, he's a pretty private guy.
He was extremely private. After a heart attack in 2004, he basically disappeared for 10 years. He was at home with his family, tending to his business, nursing his health. And then in 2013, he released his first album in a decade, The Next Day. And that touched off his latest artistic renaissance. And his most two recent albums, The Next Day and Black Star, are among his very best.
And he was only 69 years old.
Yes, he was.
We don't think of that as being old these days. Well, thank you so much for stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you so much, Susan.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Around the world, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Vietnam, Syria, Russia, Iran, and other countries, journalists are under siege and freedom of expression is under threat. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that in 2014, more than 60 journalists were killed, hundreds imprisoned, and dozens remain missing. Reporters Without Borders notes that governmental attempts to silence journalists include censorship, harassment, restrictive NGO laws, and public threats by political leaders. Speaking at Columbia University in New York, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs Richard Stengel, himself a former journalist, described freedom of expression as a foundational human right. Challenges to that freedom, he said, are now deeper and more profound than at any time in decades. He described three: the physical dangers journalists confront in conflict zones and elsewhere, the shrinking space for free expression in countries with autocratic leadership, and the rise of disinformation. In the past, journalists trying to expose the truth were given a kind of safe pass, said Undersecretary Stengel. Now they are targets of regimes and of terrorists like ISIL. As such, supporting freedom of the press is a critical element of U.S. foreign policy. It is one of the issues that our diplomats around the world regularly address in bilateral talks with governments. One initiative provides trainings to journalists on physical and digital security and psychosocial care throughout the world. And the U.S. has invested over $100 million in internet freedom programs to provide tools and trainings to thousands of vulnerable civil society and independent journalists around the world. Finally, in response to the rise of disinformation from terrorist groups or autocratic regimes, the U.S. is being proactive, said Undersecretary Stengel, in claiming the space for truth-telling by pushing back on propaganda and falsehood with fact-based messages, as well as by supporting independent media around the world with financial, technical, and logistical support. And why? Because as President Barack Obama has said, journalists give all of us as citizens the chance to know the truth about our countries, ourselves, our governments. That makes us better. It makes us stronger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.